By November, everywhere it seemed, users were out to test the boundaries Satoshi had set. Some claiming his design was flawed, while others went so far as to argue his system did little more than unjustly enrich himself. Though the logic is dated and steeped in misunderstanding, it's hard not to view these posts as a prism of the times, of both the concern that changes by developers might harm investors, and the already strong echo that it is the users who hold ultimate authority over the system. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And man, we have got an awesome piece today. This is an amazing walk through some Bitcoin history and the early days, the conversations, the realizations, and the tone around development during the days of Satoshi. How was Satoshi treated while he was, quote, master of the project? Was he really the master? And what exactly do we know about Satoshi's disappearance? This is another wonderful piece from Bitcoin Magazine, just released. In fact, hopefully this will be released. The audio will be released right when the article is released, if I can get this out right in time here. And it is from Pete Rizzo, returning author, and I will have links to his other great work that we have already done on the show, like The Battle for P2SH, which is another one of my favorites. So don't forget to check those out as well. Quick shout out to my favorite hardware wallet, the Bitbox O2 from Shift Crypto. It's got the, I personally have the Bitcoin only version. And it is now a really easy setup with Spectre to use in multi-sig. For anybody else who has who is a fan of Spectre out there like myself, Bitbox is super easy to use with it. And discount code GUY, G-U-Y, gets you 5% off your whole cart. Do not forget the code. Don't spend money that you don't have to. GUY is really easy to spell also. So, you know, don't miss out on that. Then, of course, the best automatic savings plan in the business, swanbitcoin.com/guy for my referral. Gets you a couple free sats to start off. I auto stack every single week. It never stops. It is automatic. And then it sends it automatically, safely to my Bitbox hardware wallet. So I get peace of mind, and I'm always stacking. And then I just do a bunch of instant buys in between. These are our amazing sponsors. Who make Bitcoin Audible possible. Show them some love, and you can find them both at guyswan.com. But without further ado, let's get into today's article from Bitcoin Magazine and Pete Rizzo, and it is titled, The Last Days of Satoshi. What happened when Bitcoin's creator disappeared? Written by Pete Rizzo. Edited by Aaron Von Wertham. Tradition demands that there is no gap between kings. Terry Pratchett. They suspected that he was British, that he was Yakuza, that he laundered money. They wondered if he was a woman, laid claim just in case, and joked about fucking him. They kept contingencies for if he proved crazy, eyed for shifts in his sleep, debated why he spoke and didn't speak, and sent him eager patches signed with pretty please. To be sure, by the waning days of 2010, Satoshi Nakamoto was still acknowledged for inventing Bitcoin, and was respected for growing the first decentralized digital currency into a $1 million market. But as frustrations with his authority and availability built, it became all too common for users to decry Satoshi the admin, Satoshi the bottleneck, Satoshi the dictator. If it can be said a quiet clamor against Bitcoin's creator had been simmering since summer, it soon became something of an outcry. As demands escalated, Satoshi sightings even assumed the role of sport, with users speculating when and why he might appear on the forums. That's not to say Satoshi was able to bring order to the discussion if and when he surfaced. Indeed, as winter approached, a noticeable change in the conversation would begin with a wave of posts casting doubt over the project, and more specifically, Satoshi's role in its operations. In response, users drew a dividing line. It was not Satoshi, then still directing development, but the users who ran the software, who were the project's ultimate authority. Quote, "There is no single mastermind in open source. It's more of a brain where a single human is just a cell," wrote Shadow of Harbinger. If one day Satoshi says, "Okay guys, it was just a joke with this Bitcoin thing, I'm closing down the project," we could simply fork the code. This line of defense was echoed broadly, even by Satoshi's most active assistant, Gavin Andreessen, who wrote in no uncertain terms, quote, "If Satoshi goes rogue, then the project forks." At the heart of this defense was a growing belief, stronger perhaps than even any confidence in Satoshi himself, that no Bitcoin user could be greater or less than any other, that they were all nodes on the network, authors of code, individuals responsible for the software's success. Still, the coming weeks would find Bitcoin's early users exercising this power in ways that would upend assumptions about the software's usability, politics, limitations, and freedoms. In the end, this awakening would amount to something more, the first assertion of authority over Bitcoin's creator and his system of rules, one already defined by choices so absolute they may as well have been divine. Wrote user Thrashaholic to one early critic, quote, "So, you are comfortable with the laws of nature determining how much gold, silver, platinum, palladium is to be had? Name those laws God if you will. It is no different than Satoshi." I, innocence. For Satoshi, this might have all seemed a far cry from the quiet of 2009, when in the months after he released, the first Bitcoin software reviews were often muted when made at all. Indeed, as the year came to a close, the optimism that had so pervaded his early emails with famed cypherpunk Hal Finney would have faded into the distant past, while even casual responses to the Bitcoin mailing list had tapered off almost entirely. But if Satoshi was by then convinced of the science behind Bitcoin and could expound on its virtues as money, it is perhaps his addition of a simple forum feature to its official website that proves he had begun to think more deeply about the need to evangelize for his invention. Certainly, it's possible to infer the Bitcoin.org forums, launched in November 2009, would have done much to break the quiet surrounding his still obscure project. A year after going live, it had processed just over 200 transactions and lacked any available exchange rate. Adding energy to the project already was computer science student Marty Sirius Malmy, who devoted spare time to bug fixes, but the forums expanded this team of two. Asked what the price of Bitcoin should be, New Liberty Standard would give a fumbling first reply, quote, "Paper bowls, no more than 50 count, factory sealed." Together, the forum users would provide a better answer, establishing a first exchange and encouraging stores to accept the currency. At the edges of cyberspace, Satoshi watched over it all. The lead developer and his sometimes assistant pushing close to 50 updates to the code that first year. Users updated often and in short order, disbelief suspended by a step into the unknown. Drip by drip. What Satoshi thought of the initial visitors to the Bitcoin.org website, we can only guess. But by accounts, he appears to have been a humble and responsive host. Certainly most offered no more information about themselves than Satoshi, some adopting inelegant nicks like Gick, Zuni, and Rix, others pseudonyms that were prosaic, smoke too much, or political, one currency now, but almost never personal. One name, however, would immediately stand out on arrival: Gavin Andreessen. As opposed to the singular Sirius or Satoshi, the alias was, of course, discernible as a full name, complete with an irregular given name, Gavin, and succeeding surname, Andreessen. Adding to the contrast would be his choice of avatar. Whereas most user profiles were no more than empty gray squares, Andreessen played a smiling hiker ambling a trail. The image was apt. By May 2010, Bitcoin was hardly a beaten path. Drawing Andreessen and a first wave of Silicon Valley startup types was Bitcoin's modest debut in the pages of InfoWorld. But it would take more than a name to attract notice on the increasingly active forums, and Andreessen's first effort, launched in early June, would ensure he did just that. Quote, "For my first Bitcoin coding project, I decided to do something that sounds really dumb. I created a website that gives away Bitcoins. I've stocked it with 1,100 Bitcoins to start. Why? Because I want the Bitcoin project to succeed," he wrote in its announcement. The Bitcoin faucet, as the website would come to be called, was greeted with acclaim, winning attention from early contributors like Laszlo, and quickly growing more mythic than his recent purchase of 2 Papa John's pizzas. More than a simple exchange, the faucet was an act of imagination, one that would help make real Bitcoin's potential for online trade. Whereas the money of the past sat stiffly in accounts, taking days to move between banks, payments flowed freely from the Bitcoin faucet from one internet user to the next. Within a week, Satoshi himself responded to the work, calling it, quote, "an excellent choice for a first project." "I had planned to do this exact thing if someone else didn't do it, so when it gets too hard for mortals to generate 50 BTC, new users could get some coins to play with right away," he wrote. The reply was enough to encourage Andreessen to reach out to Satoshi in response, though his tone would betray just how different the two collaborators would be. "I'm very curious to hear more about you. How old are you? Is Satoshi your real name? Do you have a day job? What projects have you been involved with before?" Andreessen wrote. "Anyway, Bitcoin is a brilliant idea and I want to help. What do you need?" That Andreessen's name had its own complex history, or that he was once widely known as Gavin Alexander Bell, was not yet a matter of anyone's concern. Nor would have been the irony in the idea his life was about to enter the shadow of yet another great inventor. The Great Slashdotting. Trading by late June at nearly a penny apiece and seeing double-digit transaction counts daily, Bitcoin, it seemed, was on the verge of catching on. If the forums were bustling, so too was the caliber of its coders increasing, the releases becoming a communal and collaborative affair. It wouldn't be long before even Satoshi was swept up in the optimism, and as Laszlo, Gavin, and a small clique of coders tested his builds, confidence got better of even his keyboard when he suddenly announced the possibility that Bitcoin might exit beta. At a time when most were compiling the code, the idea of a 1.0 release was headline news. Quote, "We should try to get publicity, simultaneously advertising on forums, IRC, YouTube, Facebook, Google Ads. Slashdot, with its millions of tech-savvy readers, would be awesome, perhaps the best imaginable," Sirius wrote, leading a charge of excited replies. Soon the forums were fussing over the finer points of a press statement, debating if Bitcoin was really, quote, "energy-backed," or whether anyone would care about its finite supply. That the effort carried on, even as Satoshi changed his mind, publishing the release with its momentous one expunged, was evidence Bitcoin was a community project as intended. Still, Satoshi's conservatism would prove prescient. Soon after listing on Slashdot, Bitcoin's infrastructure was all but overwhelmed, the price surging as high as 10 cents, while difficulty quadrupled as more and more mining power poured online. With it, high-tech tricksters like William Ninolod Pitcock swiftly descended, seeking to stress the Bitcoin economy for science and sport. Quote, "Bitcoin exchange demolished. 84,732 BTC sold for 1,500 euro profit. Lol, he tweeted. As a wave of fear swept the forums, there was speculation the network might be under attack by everyone from spiteful bankers to rogue server farm operators. With so much excitement, it was only a matter of time before the market finally burst, falling back to a low of 5 cents. The once full faucet emptied, its payout reduced. A strange block. But with every Bitcoin wave, new users wash ashore. So, even as Satoshi began merging Andreessen's code more regularly, he was far from the only one chipping away at the work. Certainly, there was nothing stopping eager contributors. Satoshi's email was listed directly in the Bitcoin.org homepage, and his name, virtually unknown beyond the forums, would have hardly appeared prestigious. Tiago Faria recalls sending Satoshi a translation of the website, localizing the file on a flight to Lisbon, and receiving an enthusiastic thanks on landing. When Rybuck had issues compiling, Satoshi turned down a reward for the fix. Quote, "I have plenty of bitcoins," he replied. Likewise, David Parrish was listed as a contributor after expressing only a fleeting interest in learning to code. In short, it was hardly an honor to work on the protocol. Those with the means to contribute simply came and went, like Laszlo, who was MIA by August and soon absent for good. Further, for those who pressed on, it was often a means to an end. Andreessen was busy testing a, quote, super-secret faucet follow-up with commercial ambitions. On leave from a part-time programming job, he harbored the hope Bitcoin would help him find work from Amherst, Massachusetts, a university town where capitalism is more tolerated than encouraged, and Boston's bright offices are a full day's drive east. If Bitcoin's inventor was short revealing his background or circumstances, it was hard for others to tell if he was reserved or simply busy. Still, as the summer of 2010 came to close, so would the era of Satoshi's ambiguity. If it can be said there was magic to Satoshi's code, so was there a reverence for Satoshi the magician, the alchemist who had spun C++ into the Philosopher's Stone. That immaculate image would suffer its first crack on August 15, 2010, when 184 billion bitcoins would suddenly appear on the blockchain. No small screw-up. The critical exploit of the code, an unprecedented violation of its monetary policy, was the work of an adversary able to modify the software and subvert its intricate distributed accounting system. As stunned users spread word across the forums, Andreessen and other developers scrambled to identify a solution. Still, it would be Satoshi who both wrote and pushed the patch. In the aftermath, it would fall on user Free Money to cut to the quick, noting just how reliant the software had become on its maintainer king. Quote, "Did we get lucky? Or is there a secret pager that alerts Satoshi to emergencies?" 2. Disillusion. In the weeks that followed, Bitcoin was back online and operational, which is to say that users continued to run the software to hold value, validate transactions, and build the new blockchain. In that sense, the value overflow exploit was, quite literally, a thing of the past. But if it's true the attack violated the rules of the Bitcoin network, so too did it expose that very system of rules, revealing for the first time its mechanics and management. In its wake, Satoshi would move swiftly to bolster the code, adding and removing parts as if boarding for a storm. He took action to throttle perceived attack vectors, disabling commands for complex transactions, hard-coding checkpoint blocks into the software, and installing an alert system allowing him to broadcast critical warnings to all clients. In some ways, his actions were understandable. Bitcoin was under a quiet siege only he would have been able to detect. By July 2010, users had begun to excavate the code in earnest. And while most reported exploits to him, There was no guarantee this altruism would continue. Still, Satoshi's actions would show that not all Bitcoin rules were equal. The nature of consensus remained that all users needed to agree on all the rules for valid blocks to recognize a single blockchain history and thus a common currency. But so-called policy rules sat outside this check, giving him latitude on the rules he could apply to transactions in the name of safety. How much should a transaction cost? Should there be restrictions on transaction types? Can any transaction be considered unwanted, undesirable, or even harmful to the network? On these questions, Satoshi was less collaborative, less clear about what his choices implied. Complicating matters is that he appears to have been open, at least tacitly, to repositioning the software's selling points in the name of adoption. As far back as 2009, Satoshi had given serious credentials to Bitcoin.org, and between semesters again he was using them freely, adding translations and an FAQ. Notably, this included a new addition describing the project's, quote, advantages. Quote, Bitcoin transactions are practically free, whereas credit cards and online payment systems typically cost 1 to 5% per transaction, plus various other merchant fees up to hundreds of dollars. The updated website read, perhaps unsurprisingly, it's here, where magic internet money collided with real-world costs, that we first see a questioning of Satoshi's authority, a bristling at the boundaries between his directions and what developers and users might decide. The gatekeeper. In the end, the value overflow bug would split the Bitcoin blockchain for a total of 5 hours, orphaning 53 blocks before users restored the intended network rules. But if today such a compromise would be met with significant soul-searching, back then it was cause for celebration. An early Bitcoin fan blog went as far as to boast the issue was patched faster than critical fixes at Google and Microsoft. More surprising might be how little conversation flowed from Satoshi at all. Apart from a mailing list warning, there does not seem to have been any post-mortem. Undiscussed was not just the nature of the bug, but the manner of the fork, how Satoshi tightened the rules enforced by all users unilaterally, his patch adjusting the rules for transaction inputs and outputs. Even if other developers had any questions about what happened, it wasn't exactly clear where they would have been asked. Attempts had been made to hold a developer meeting over the summer, but had largely stalled in Satoshi's absence. To be fair, it's unclear if Satoshi wanted any input. Weeks prior, he would quietly tighten rules on the size of blocks, implementing an obscure protocol rule called max block size and pushing it unannounced as part of a routine update. Such an instance occurred again in late July, when Satoshi released an update with the preface, "Please upgrade to 0.3.6 ASAP," merging code he hadn't published for review. Not that he didn't have a good reason for the change. This appears to have been the result of a bug that, if exploited, made it possible for an attacker to spend bitcoins they didn't own. But this distance was not without repercussions. Andreessen, for one, could be seen thinking over the development process with newcomer Jeff Garzik, a veteran Linux contributor inspired by Slashdot, to begin inspecting the Bitcoin code. That the two would have found much in common isn't surprising. Also a new dad, Garzik was a startup veteran residing on the outskirts of Raleigh, North Carolina, where he lived and worked from a 1980s Fleetwood RV. As IRC shows, a working friendship quickly between the two emerged. Gavin Andreessen. I just wish I could convince Satoshi to switch to a more collaborative development model. Tritonio.
What do you mean? What is the current development model?
Jay Garzik. Mostly closed. Open source, closed development. Gavin Andreessen. Satoshi is the gatekeeper right now. All code flows through him. A quiet leak. Whatever the reason, users and developers simply appear to have grown more comfortable
confronting issues of Satoshi's authority as the calendar turned to fall. Garzik took to the task with sharper elbows, opening threads that took on thornier questions about system economics. First, he would probe Bitcoin's fee policy, proposing to eliminate free transactions under the premise they were simply passed on as hidden storage costs. Satoshi stopped short of removing the subsidy entirely, outlining both the current fee threshold, 200 kilobytes or roughly 1,000 transactions per block were free, and why he supported only a lower 50 kilobyte limit. Quote, Bitcoin should always allow at least some free transactions, he felt. In lieu of objections to his logic, Satoshi moved quickly to enact his preferred change, merging it just 2 weeks later. Still, some users appear to have been left grumbling at the effective cost increase, arguing it was the market, not developers, that should set fees. In the wake of the change, developers like Andreessen appeared confused about how the network dealt with fees, and so were unable to assist in answering questions. That this was an issue was because, as the network grew, it made it less likely any issue could be elevated to Satoshi. By then, users were already circulating custom patches to the software, unofficial additions that fixed minor issues or enhanced the performance of mining code. For his part, Satoshi appears to have recognized the strain, granting Andreessen access to update the software directly by October, and he would bring a newfound accessibility to the task, engaging users on IRC even as Satoshi served as the final stamp of approval. Larger questions, however, continued to depend on Satoshi's edict. When Garzik proposed an increase to the new block size limit, coding a patch to, quote, match PayPal's transaction rate, Satoshi again deferred, asserting a change could be made, quote, if we get closer to needing it. That the response feels incomplete today is because it appears Garzik was passively asking how developers might deal with, quote, incompatible changes, ones that didn't just tighten the rules for all users, but expanded or even introduced new rules to the software. Even then, some were already wondering how such decisions could ever be settled by Satoshi or any benevolent dictator, with newcomer Vladimir von der Laan arguing this precedent could set the system on a dangerous path towards centralization. Wampus. Indeed, the developer should set the protocol, not policy on fees. Wampus. Otherwise, we can call Mr. Satoshi dear leader. 3. Confrontation. As criticisms escalated, Satoshi appears to have remained active and online, but even he would struggle to keep pace with the volume and urgency of conversation ahead. By November, everywhere it seemed, users were out to test the boundaries Satoshi had set, some claiming his design was flawed, while others went so far as to argue his system did little more than unjustly enrich himself. Though the logic is dated and steeped in misunderstanding, it's hard not to view these posts as a prism of the times, of both the concern that changes by developers might harm investors and the already strong echo that it is the users who hold ultimate authority over the system. Unsurprisingly, most of these attacks took aim at the more arbitrary rules Satoshi had seemingly ordained, the 21 million limit on the Bitcoin supply bearing most of the brunt. Mises. How on earth can you be comfortable with some random dude picking the amount of currency in circulation? Kiba. Who will pick the number then? Thrashaholic. I accept Satoshi's cap a lot more than I do Bernanke's. Mises. A bunch of random dudes is much better than one random. Art4s. The only important part is that it's fixed, enforced by all peers, and known to everyone in advance. Notably, it is here where users began to unite behind the idea they could exercise authority over Bitcoin, effectively copying it and carrying on if they ever disagreed with the decisions made by Satoshi or any developer. Michael, quote, Thamos Markart, who operates the successor to the Bitcoin Org forums, would be a powerful early voice for this thinking. When Satoshi pushed an update, he argued he was only proposing a change, one users had to approve when they downloaded the code. Marquardt went on to extrapolate the logic further, pushing back on claims a new software, even one with improved features, could still be Bitcoin if users didn't agree. Quote, "Clearly I'm willing to bet my balance on the security of the system," he wrote in one sharp reply. "Feel free to make a different version with stupid rules. No one will use it." Soon, the then 20-year-old college student from Wisconsin would raise the first challenge to Satoshi's authority, though he wouldn't be alone in pushing Bitcoin thought to new extremes. Decimals to DNS. It might be fitting that this unraveling starts with a question of decimals.
All right, let's take a quick break right here for our sponsor today, and we will jump back in on this section from decimals to DNS. So, I've been migrating more and more of my hardware wallet usage to Bitbox, and the other day I was kind of wondering what specifically makes me want to grab that one before any of the other options, because I have like 8 hardware wallets. And so I actually just lined them all up and went through logging into and using each one, and there were 2 things that stood out to me. First, the Bitbox is really quick to use. I actually still just use the Bitbox app that comes with it because it's a really clean UI. And I also recommend Spectre to everybody. Spectre's a great wallet to use it with. But then the other thing is that it just looks better than the other ones. You know, it's got a lot of great features that I talk about all the time. It's open source, which many of these actually can't boast. It's got a micro SD card backup as well as the normal backup, but I really like that just for simplicity. You know, you just keep your micro SD card in your safe. But I really think kind of the way it looks and feels to use might be what makes me gravitate to my Bitbox more than anything else. So if you're finally ready to hold your own keys and you want to be Bitcoin sovereign, discount code GUY, G-U-Y, gets you 5% off. Always buy from the manufacturer just for security reasons, but in this case, it also gives you a discount. So check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox. It'll take you straight to the Bitcoin-only version of the Bitbox O2. Decimals to DNS. It might be fitting that this unraveling starts with a question of decimals. As most users knew, Bitcoins were like no money ever before, divisible down to 8 places, the smallest units then undefined by any term at all. Adding confusion was that in practice, wallets rounded to 2 digits, like dollars and cents, the decision dating back to the source code. Quote, "It seems like a good idea to me to come to a consensus now about when to move the decimal points," Andreessen wrote. "When bitcoins are worth more than about $10 or euros each, I think it'll be time to allow sub-bit penny payments." The question was, of course, one of policy, of how or if the software would change to ease adoption. But on display quickly was the sheer subjectivity of such decisions, with users debating for pages if their mothers knew the term milli or the exact meaning of micro. Elsewhere, Matthew Appomatto Willis was busy stretching the concept of Bitcoin to its limit in a thread that marked the first exploration of how a multi-blockchain world might work. Could applications exist on top of Bitcoin? Or was Bitcoin destined to be rebuilt on another kind of blockchain on which 1,000 coins could bloom? So quick did the thread catch fire that users began to clamor for Satoshi, unsure of whether to fork first or ask for his approval. "I think it would be possible for BitDNS to be a completely separate network and separate blockchain, yet share CPU power with Bitcoin," Satoshi wrote after some 12 pages of debate. "While you are generating Bitcoins, why not also get free domain names for the same work?" That the thread became something of a phenomenon is evidenced by the reemergence of Hal Finney, who asked Satoshi outright if he was, quote, endorsing the idea of multiple blockchains, each of which would, quote, create their own flavor of coins. While a complete dissection of the ideas at hand would take years and is arguably still ongoing, it's notable there were already objections to Satoshi's, quote, sidechains solution. So too was the doubt about whether he could even know where the revolution he started was heading. Quote, the unstated elephant in the room, the one thing that everybody wants to avoid but isn't being stated, is the need to create a parallel currency to Bitcoin because Bitcoin itself is inadequate at accomplishing the task at hand, wrote user R. Horning. It was Garzik who was perhaps the most vocal that Bitcoin should be a currency only, though he would go on to encourage the creation of new blockchains outside Satoshi's authority. Quote, get over the fear of forking. Embrace multiple competing blockchains with competing rule sets, he wrote. Let Satoshi be the benevolent dictator of the main chain. We need competition. Set in stone. A still bigger rebuke to Satoshi's authority would take place in a matter of days, when he again moved to curb the use of advanced commands with a policy rule called Is Standard. Advertised as a way to, quote, prevent possible security problems we haven't thought of, by Andreessen and Satoshi, users who updated were agreeing to only relay transaction types deemed safe by developers and checked by the software against a default list. That this was an infringement on user freedoms was obvious to Mark Hart, who was working on not only an attempt to realize BitDNS, but a separate use case for a kind of scratch card, both of which now used non-standard commands for transactions. For developers who had been seeking to build on the code, the effect was stifling, and Mark Hart soon coded a patch designed to unwind the policy. But the next day, he was asking miners if they would reject the measure, and some voiced support for the alternative software, eager to exercise their right to mine transactions that might earn higher fees. Fueling passions against the effort was Garzik, who claimed that Mark Hart and the miners were trying to split the network, though the software was only adjusting policy. In turn, Mark Hart would offer his preferred view, that it is users who decide Bitcoin's rules, writing, quote, the market is deciding on the best possible policies. I have nothing to do with it. For his part, Andreessen sought to downplay tensions, asserting change would always be easy on the Bitcoin network so long as it had popular consent. Please stop acting like the current is standard test is set in stone, he countered. It is not, and as Satoshi said, new versions of the client are rapidly adopted by a majority of the network, so introducing a new transaction type will not be a big deal. In private messages, Satoshi concurred with Andreessen, noting no one, quote, could stop anyone from attempting to build something like a sidechain, and that he supported accommodating the idea. There's no hurry, he wrote in reply. I don't like to design things for pie in the sky. It may be best to have the first use implemented first, and see what it actually needs. The Hornet's Nest. But as disagreements piled up on the technical side, yet another thread would at last plunge the spiraling debate into the mire of politics. Pushing forward the discussion this time would be free software proponent Amir Taki, who had asked in November if Bitcoin might aid the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks, then under siege as PayPal and global banks blacklisted it from the financial system. By early December, a Slashdot-style effort was up and running on the forums, and users appear to have quickly succeeded at getting the idea to the WikiLeaks leadership. But while the group ultimately declined to accept Bitcoin as payment at the time, rumor spread faster than fact, and soon PC World had published an article airing the idea. Some choose now to view the moment as a kind of last straw for Satoshi, one they feel might have driven home the retribution he could face if unmasked as Bitcoin's inventor. It would have been nice to get this attention in any other context, WikiLeaks has kicked the hornet's nest, and the swarm is headed towards us, he wrote. Still, Satoshi's position wouldn't be viewed with sympathy on IRC, nor would reports that someone had locked the official forum post so that users were unable to reply. Diabol D3. Yes, Satoshi basically needs to be removed from leadership. What he's doing is censorship, just like any other. If I want to donate to WikiLeaks using BTC, everyone else can suck my dick. The final blow. Software version 0.3.19, Satoshi's last, would arrive the next day on December 13th. Read now, like the final public message from Bitcoin's creator, it seems tactical that he chose to wind down measures taken in the wake of the value overflow exploit, a sign he might have felt his mission to lock down compromises to the code had been realized. Still, it's difficult to say if Satoshi's decision to walk away was even his own. After all, over the year, there had been a dramatic change in tone toward his leadership. As to whether he intended to leave, however, Satoshi was definite. His sign-off observable when he removed his name from Bitcoin's copyright statements. Thereafter, he would also update Bitcoin.org, adding the names and emails of other developers, including Andreessen, Sirius, Laszlo, and Neil Schneider, to its contact page while removing his own. What little we know about the transition was represented by Andreessen publicly when he claimed a week later to have received Satoshi's, quote, blessing to start more active project management. In the interim, Andreessen assumed the trappings of authority, putting out a help wanted post and making clear to new volunteers they would now need to move the project forward. Quote, who is willing and able to help out? Don't ask permission, just jump in, wrote Andreessen. Your reward will be recognition, admiration, and respect. It is time to take Bitcoin from essentially a single programmer project to a robust, open source project with tons of contributors. Part 4. Disappearance. It was the kind of thing he knew would create conspiracy theories, and it did. Though many events loom in the Bitcoin lore, few compete with Gavin Andreessen's infamous visit with U.S. intelligence in June 2011. In the decades since, the event has been linked to everything from the alleged murder of Satoshi Nakamoto to the start of a years-long effort to subvert the network and bring it under government control. Indeed, by modern sentiments, the idea that one of Bitcoin's leading technical figures would in any way engage with U.S. agencies is tantamount to heresy, a perversion of its most enduring value proposition, preserving the first digital money free from government influence. Yet, that this is still a matter of such spurious conjecture is perhaps because it is rooted in fact. Not only did Andreessen attend such an event, but it appears true that Satoshi continued to work on Bitcoin, if only behind the scenes, up until the day Andreessen accepted the invitation. What we know is that into January, Andreessen, Malmy, and Satoshi all appear to have discussed strategy actively via private email. Advocating for more public outreach was Andreessen, who had volunteered, assuming Satoshi didn't, quote, want to deal with any media. I think it is better to give a realistic impression of Bitcoin. It is cutting-edge beta software that is still being developed. It is not poised to replace PayPal or the Euro soon, Andreessen wrote. In response, Satoshi told Andreessen that he was the best person to give any interviews. Complicating matters, however, is that as Andreessen vaulted into the limelight, it's unclear if he continued to remain aligned with Bitcoin's creator on project goals and vision. He would prove inconsistent in remarks, describing development as a controlled anarchy in a March interview, yet noting he felt that he and Satoshi reserved the right to enact unilateral change if it was ever needed. By April, Andreessen would even begin to theorize about the kinds of policies that could only be brought by radical changes to the network, predicting someday, quote, only larger organizations would pay attention to every transaction, while proposing one day fees might be, quote, paid by merchants. For Andreessen, scaling the capacity of the network for more transactions was a matter of when, not if, and it was clear already he was open to concessions to realize this vision. Quote, "Right now I can run Bitcoin on my personal computer. As we scale up, that won't be possible. For now, people who like the fact that they can use their home computers, they might not be so happy if they have to start trusting people to run one of these servers." The last message. The alleged final break between Satoshi and his collaborators would come on April 26, 2011. According to records from Andreessen, Satoshi had sent him an email that day in which he asked him to downplay the idea he was a, quote, "mysterious, shadowy figure," at the time adopting a short and reproachful tone to the project's new technical lead. "The press just turns that into a pirate currency angle. Maybe instead make it about the open source project and give more credit to your contributors. It helps motivate them," Satoshi wrote. This was followed by a separate message that contained only a copy of the cryptographic key to Bitcoin's alert system, one that effectively gave Andreessen sole control over security notifications. In response, Andreessen would acknowledge the advice, but he quickly moved to more pressing matters, informing Satoshi about his intentions to attend a, quote, "annual conference on emerging technologies for U.S. intelligence." "It might be really stupid if it just raises Bitcoin's visibility on their radar, but I think it is way too late for that. Bitcoin is already on their radar," he wrote. The next day, he would announce the appearance on the Bitcoin forums as indicated. The news prompted widespread commentary, but surprisingly, little pushback among developers like Vladimir von der Laan, Christian Decker, and Mini Rosenfeld, who all backed the move on the basis that open engagement with authority would be a welcome change. Bitcoin users debated Andreessen's actions too, but here also it's evident his decision not to shy away from authority was widely popular. As opposed to remaining silent as Satoshi had, there is a sense Andreessen was bringing a more principled tone to project leadership. Quote, "All this proves is that Bitcoin is a meritocracy, and that Gavin has earned his position as lead developer through peer review," wrote Anonymous. Others argued Satoshi had promoted Gavin to, quote, "take command," citing as evidence how his email was added to Bitcoin.org. To some, Andreessen was, quote, "not chosen, but rather stepped up to the task," the remark highlighting the dominant opinion that continues to be presented today. Still, as discussion shows, few were worried about the idea Satoshi might never return. Kiba. "Will Satoshi come back, Gavin Andreessen?" Blue Matt. "Last I heard, he had, quote, moved on to other projects, and that Bitcoin is in good hands." Kiba. "So what's official statement?" Gavin. "I don't know. He said he's moving on to other things, so expect him to fade away even more." Full circle. Still, if Satoshi was at the start of descending into mystery, Bitcoin was anything but, surpassing $3 in the latter days of April and breaking into public consciousness for the first time. With Bitcoin trading firmly above the dollar, the press would descend. The reporters were on the lookout for a face to attach to the project's name. When Forbes came to call, it was Gavin and his, quote, "cadre of underground cypherpunks," it profiled, Satoshi only appearing as a footnote. But as interest in the project grew, so too did its creator become more entwined with the man who remained to tell his story. Quote, "I've never met Satoshi Nakamoto. I've never spoken to him on the telephone," Andreessen would say, but still the stories kept on and on. Indeed, it would be Andreessen himself who would first air the idea he believed Satoshi's exit was connected with the CIA event, an opinion he'd give on a YouTube show in its aftermath. From these seeds would sprout still another tall tale. As enduring as the myth of the unknown Satoshi would be, the myth of good-natured Gavin, Bitcoin's Batman, its silent protector, its undisputed captain, whose goodwill would help win the trust of users. Where did one story end and the other begin? The successor defined by his predecessor, as he in turn was defined by his absence. Over time, they developed a tone when they asked him the question, subdued, dramatic. "So," the reporters from the New Yorker would ask, "I'd like to know more about Nakamoto." "So would I," Andreessen would say, his laughter described as rueful, ringing, and believable. The Last Days of Satoshi by Pete Rizzo. So the amount of scouring that was done to put this piece together is pretty incredible. There's like 120 citations, and the links throughout are just absolutely riddled. Rizzo really did his homework for this one, and actually there are a couple of quotes that are actually asterisked in this that are from private emails between Gavin and Satoshi. And one of those actually I thought was interesting was that basically with the final message or the very final days of Satoshi is he had sent Andreessen an email saying, please try to downplay and stop like giving in to the framing that he's some mysterious shadowy figure. And, you know, and he was kind of reproachful about it and saying, focus attention back to the other collaborators, to the fact that this is an open source project, etc., and try to avoid focusing on the mystery of Satoshi. I think just goes to show how, you know, reluctant he was to be Satoshi in that sense of having the burden of people thinking he's the master of this project. And it would seem pretty clear to me that he wasn't really comfortable with all of the attention. It seems like the more and more attention and focus it was getting, the more he was wanting to pull back and, be distant from the project. And I think another really interesting takeaway here is how, like, looking back at the actual conversations and the forum posts and everything during these days is how Satoshi was treated while Satoshi was around, how much Satoshi was treated just like any other person in the project, in a sense, is they were annoyed, they would demand things, he was getting in the way of the project and he was dictating things. Like, Satoshi was just any other person to complain about. And then since when Satoshi left, suddenly he's revered. He's got this mythical ethos about him because we never knew who Satoshi actually was. And it completely changes the framing and how everyone relates to Satoshi or the story of Satoshi as we come in at this time, past Satoshi's disappearance. But in the end, this was all an engineering project, right? We're trying to build a system and learn from it as time goes on, and even during that era, even during the short time that, like, while Satoshi was here and other people were working on and the project was beginning to grow and become a thing of its own, there were disagreements about what was being learned, about what the direction for this thing was. There were already conversations about essentially the block size and what the major restrictions and how this thing was going to be best used. Were we going to fit all of the PayPal transactions into this? Was this going to be some Visa competitor? And then most importantly of all, as this was understood by the people who were using it and who were building on it and who were testing it out then, is the users realizing that they were in control? Is understanding the nature of the protocol, of how the system worked, and what it meant for Bitcoin to change? The hints of that were starting to be defined. And Pete actually said to me in an email, which I thought was a really interesting point to add, was that that we kind of have a pessimistic view in the idea that
either A, Satoshi was wrong in passing authority to Gavin, or that even if it was right to do so, this the very concept, our very like kind of modern view on the transition from quote unquote Satoshi to Gavin, was that the users were still always in control. Like, it doesn't really matter what Satoshi decided, or if it was quote unquote really passed down, or if Gavin had stepped up just to kind of take over or take the lead in Satoshi's absence. Neither one of those things really make a difference, do they? I mean, it's not as if Bitcoin was some different software or different protocol back then. The same dynamics were always true. The users, as soon as they realized it, were in control of the network and the protocol. They were the custodians of the current rules of the Bitcoin system. And that realization happened in the social sphere. It happened in the culture and the ideology around Bitcoin. This reminds me back of the Island of Yap and all the Rhystones and stuff. Something that really kind of shook me and was just kind of a little bit horrifying, but a little bit like just so fascinating in the exact same way about that story was that, you know, this was, you may have heard this analogy. I'm sure I've talked about this a lot on the show, but just a brief overview is the Island of Yap had this money that worked for centuries, and there were these giant limestone discs, and they just basically just sat around, and they were representative of, you know, large amounts of value, and they were exchanged virtually. So I liken this to like one of the perfect allegories to Bitcoin is that like to exchange one of these giant limestone discs or whatever, they would literally just go to the town square and they would announce to the religious authority and all the people in town that like Bob no longer owns this disc or this Rhystone. Now it belongs to Guy. I gave it to Guy and he traded me a bunch of cattle or something like that. And even there was a perfect story of the virtual nature of this thing, where there was a story of a disc that had drowned or had sunk to the bottom of the bay, so nobody could even see it anymore or knew for 100% certainty that it was there, but it remained in circulation so people could still trade it even though no one ever even saw the disc at the bottom of the bay. So it didn't actually have to be there. It was about the monetary properties and the scarcity that it invoked in being able to enforce it. But the key here that I found interesting was that when the British or the Spanish, I can't remember exactly, I think it was the British, came and discovered the Island of Yap and basically attempted to conquer or exact control over the island and its people, one of the things they did was quote-unquote confiscate some of their stones. And the way that they would do this, they didn't actually pick the Rhystones up and put them on the ship and take them away. They would paint a red X on them as a tax. They would just mark them as belonging to the British. And the users, quote unquote, the islanders, would simply believe it. Notice again, it's just a virtual attack. It's just in the mind of the people that now this stone that's still just sitting there on the island belongs to the British. As long as they falsely believed that the ownership was given to them, as long as the social sphere, the ownership of it, was actually believed to be in the British hands, then it was. And it was basically their failure to recognize that it was simply their choice. Now, granted, they didn't really have any defense against this. So if the British just came and, you know, brought their guns and swords and stuff and decided they were just going to take a bunch of their belongings, they were going to do that and proved that they were very willing to do that. So
obviously the system itself was completely in the social sphere and it didn't actually enforce any of it. But it just shows you how potent the idea, the thought of who owns what and who has the power is in the protection of the system itself. And Bitcoiners kind of had to realize that. There was a time where, like, as you're learning more and more about this thing, you go into it in the very, very early days, and this is Satoshi's project that you're getting to play around with. But as time goes on, as the network builds out, as you get to look at it, as you learn about it, you're like, no, I am running Bitcoin. Like, this is code being run on my computer. I am an enforcer for my network rules. The users have always been in control. It was the nature of the network. And unlike the British example and the island of Yap, you can't paint them with an X. It has to be put into the protocol rules for such a thing to happen. And no matter what, they can't confiscate it. If the value is actually there in the system, they don't have the cryptographic key, they can't move the coins. And it bolsters, it solidifies, it backs up the truth of the ownership and protection by its users. The fact that the node that you run defines what Bitcoin is. But, you know, this is kind of why I refer to, particularly in the talking about like the context of altcoins and stuff, is that's why I refer to decentralization as a process of maturation, is it has to survive being tested in order to essentially earn that mantle. Because if all the users mistakenly believe there is a leader or there is someone in control and they simply do what that leader or controller says to do and download software in accordance with that, well then yeah, arbitrary changes are very easy to make. And if, you know, some quote unquote center of the network updates and everybody freaks out and they have to update to follow that center like Ethereum or something, well, then there's no decentralization. The rules are very easy to change. And if the social sphere doesn't take advantage, if it doesn't grow and mature understanding what the power and the ideology, how this thing is defined and how it is protected, then it simply won't ever develop that element. You know, just copy pasting the code does not mean you copy and paste the social sphere, the decentralization and the breadth of the clients that exist out there, the number of computers, the network itself, the infrastructure, all of the different financial markets and liquidity pairs and all the different countries and adoption. You just copy the code. You don't copy the system. That's why I use the analogy of, you know, you can copy the DNA of a grown man who can cut down a tree, and you can paste it into, you can clone this into an infant, you know, a fetus inside of a mother's womb, but only one of those can cut down the tree. The other still has a very long maturation process and has to survive many, many tests to actually become a grown adult who can cut down that tree. And just because they have the same code doesn't mean they are the same thing. And having realized that, when the users kind of recognize that they are in control and what this system is and how it works, and taking that control, and to see that so early on, like when they're annoyed with Satoshi for making decisions or you know, potentially getting in the way, and it's like, do we have to ask his permission? It's just funny to look back in that context and see how uncertain this project was, how uncertain the future was, and the direction of all of this, and how difficult it was to see into the future what potential problems there would be, how this thing was going to scale, how it was actually going to meet all of these different needs and how it would develop, and that even the users would say, oh, how would Satoshi even know how this revolution would play out? And you know, exactly what would be involved. And then the reverence of some people like BSV or whatever, who will just rip everything we've learned about the system and everything that it has grown and matured into since then, rip it all out and take it all the way back to the very first iterations just so they can quote unquote be true Satoshi's vision, I think the real Satoshi would see that as idiotic. It's just completely idiotic. Is it like, look at all these, this is an engineering project. What God here knows what the hell is going on? We were having these arguments from day one. This was a debate. The very first thing that was a response was a discussion, an argument about how it was going, how it was actually going to work. And we've learned all of these things. We've seen these things be tested. The number of things we know about Bitcoin now and how it can scale, how it can protect itself against massive adversaries. How many things were all of the developers and all the people and everything wrong about in some various context, or in, you know, like just leaning in the wrong way or thinking about the security of the system incorrectly? And that's never going to stop. We're never going to be completely right about it. It is a new thing. We are learning it as it is living. Like, as it's growing and evolving, we're having to observe to understand Bitcoin. You know, Jameson Lopp said, nobody understands Bitcoin. And that's completely okay. That's inevitable. Bitcoin is something that we will only ever see or understand a small sliver of. But nonetheless, it is a thing. It exists in the world, and we are its custodians. We help keep it alive. We help adjust it to the realities and the things that we can learn about it and know, or at least hope that we know well enough to keep the thing alive. And I think the most important piece of that is that the users define it. Is that the users are running Bitcoin and verifying Bitcoin and keeping the rules of the system, not reliant on the trust of another person. And I find it interesting that Gavin made the comment that, oh, at some point we're going to have to run these things on big giant server farms, and regular users won't be able to run them, and the people who are used to validating and running it all themselves are going to have an issue with trusting someone else to do this for them. And I think take an issue with is a little bit of an understatement. He missed the fact that it wasn't an issue of he was going to change it and these users were going to be disappointed. The reality was that if the users wanted a system in which they did not have to trust someone else, it was their choice. And that's what was chosen. With all the caveats and trade-offs that come with that, that's the mission and the reason that Bitcoin exists, as defined by the people who protect it. This one is probably a really great one to follow up with P2SH, which is Pete Rizzo's other article that was set during the basically one of the largest first soft forks, or earliest soft forks in Bitcoin. And was a bit contentious and was basically as users were really starting to test the waters, and because there was conflict, because there was a challenge in how P2SH was actually going to be rolled out and some of the specifications of it, it was very, very lightly touching on the contention and the dynamics that we're going to be playing out years later in the block size war. So if you haven't listened to that one or read that article as well, that is a great one to follow up to learn all about Bitcoin's history and how we got to where we are today. A quick thank you to Bitbox, to Shift Crypto for the Bitbox O2 Bitcoin-only hardware wallet. I love this thing, and they are an amazing sponsor to Bitcoin Audible, bringing this content to you. Huge thank you to Bitcoin Magazine for the amazing work, as always. Pete Rizzo, killing it, man. Love it. And of course, Swan Bitcoin, the automatic Bitcoin savings plan. Check out all our sponsors at guyswan.com. right at the top of the page. And if you aren't running a node, maybe it's time to run a node and define Bitcoin for yourself. With that, this was the last days of Satoshi on Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.